Chapter 8. The Surprise lay at single anchor, well out in the channel. The wind was fair, the tide near the height of flood, and her captain stood at the rail, staring at the distant land with a grim look on his face. His hands were clasped behind his back. They clenched a little from time to time. Young Church came bounding up from the midshipman's berth into the expectant silence, filled with some unreasoning delight of his own, and he met the warning eye of his messmate Callow, who murmured, "Watch out for squalls." Jack had already seen the boat pulling away from the flagship, but this was not the boat he was waiting for. It was a man-of-war's cutter with an officer and his sea-chest in the stern sheets, his new first lieutenant sent by the facetious admiral the moment he returned from a shooting expedition up country. The boat that Jack was looking for would be a native craft, probably a filthy, and he was still looking for it when the cutter hooked onto the chains and the officer ran up the side. "Startin', sir," he said, taking off his hat. "Come aboard to join, sir, if you please."
"I'm happy to see you at last, Mr. Starton," said Jack, with a constrained smile on his lowering face. "Let us go into the coach."
He cast another glance shoreward before leading the way, but nothing did he see. They sat in silence while Jack read the admiral's letter, and Starton looked covertly at his new captain. His last had been a gloomy, withdrawn, hard-drinking man, at war with his officers, perpetually finding fault and flogging 6 days a week. Starton and every other officer aboard who did not wish to be broke had been forced into tyranny. Between them they had made the Narcissus the prettiest ship to look at east of Greenwich, and they could cross upper yards in 22 seconds, a true spit-and-polish frigate with the highest rate of punishment and desertion in the fleet. Starton's reputation was that of the hard-horse first lieutenant of the Narcissus. He did not look like a slave driver, but like a decent, pink, very close-shaved, conscientious, brisk young man. However, Jack knew what the habit of power could do, and putting the admiral's letter away, he said,
"Different ships have different ways, sir, as you are aware. I do not mean to criticise any other commander, but I desire to have things done my way in Surprise. Some people like their deck to look like a ballroom. So do I. But it must be a fighting ballroom. Gunnery and seamanship come first, and there never was a ship that fought well without she was a happy ship. If every crew can ply their gun brisk and hit the mark, and if we can make sail promptly, I do not give a damn for an occasional heap of shakings pushed under a carronade. I tell you this privately, for I should not wish to have it publicly known. But I do not think a man deserves flogging for a handful of tow. Indeed, in Surprise we do not much care for rigging the grating, either. Once the men understand their duty and have been brought to a proper state of discipline, officers who cannot keep them to it without perpetually starting them or flogging them do not know their business. I hate dirt and slovenliness, but I hate a flash ship, all spit and polish and no fighting spirit, even worse. You will say a slovenly ship cannot fight either, which is very true, so you will please to ensure the pure ideal, Mr. Starton. Another thing that I should like to say, so that we may understand one another from the beginning, is that I hate unpunctuality."
Starton's face fell still further. Through no fault of his own, he had been abominably late reporting aboard.
"I do not say this for you, but the young gentlemen are blackguards in the middle and morning watches. They are late in relieving the deck. Indeed, there is little sense of time in this ship, and at this very moment, at top of flood, I am kept waiting."
There was the sound of a boat coming alongside. Then a thin, high wrangling about the fare. Jack cocked his ear and shot upon deck with a face of thunder.
Surprise, at sea. "Sweetheart, we have picked up the monsoon after baffling winds and light airs among the laxatives, and at last I can turn to my letter again with an easy mind. We are sailing through the 8-degree channel with flowing sheets, Minicoy bearing north-northwest 4 leagues. The people are recovering from our refit in Bombay, when I must confess I pushed them pretty hard, and the dear ship is stretching away southeast under all plain sail like a thoroughbred on Epsom Downs. I was not able to do all I could have wished in the yard, as I was determined to sail on the 17th, but although we are not altogether pleased with her shifting backstays nor her trim, we did make hay while the sun shone, as they say, and with the wind 2 points free she handles as sweet as a cutter. A vastly different surprise from the pitiful thing we brought in, frapped like St. Paul's barky and pumping day and night. We logged 172 miles yesterday, and next week at this rate we should go south about Ceylon and bear away for Kampong, and it will be strange if in 2,000 miles of ocean we do not overcome her very slight tendency to gripe. It is no more. And even with her present trim, I am confident we can eat the wind out of any man-of-war in these seas. She can bear a great press of sail, and with our clean bottom I believe we could give even lively skysails, and perhaps an outer jib. Indeed, it is a great pleasure to feel her answer to a light air, and stand up stiff to a strong breeze, and if only we were heading west rather than east, I should be perfectly happy. Was she homeward bound, she would be under t'gallants and stunsails, too, for all it is Sunday afternoon. Our people behaved uncommon well in Bombay, and I feel truly obliged to them. What a capital fellow Tom Pullings is! He worked like a black, driving the hands day and night, and then when the Admiral sent this Mr. Starton to be our first lieutenant over poor Pullings's head, all the labour of refitting being over, not a word of complaint, nor a hint of being ill-used. It was heavy work, as heavy as I can remember, and the boatswain, being sick, even more fell to his share. I do not believe he went out of the ship above once, saying in his cheerful way that he knew Bombay, had often been there before, it was no more than Gosport to him. Fortunately, there was a rumour that Linois's squadron was off Cape Comorin, and that kept the men to their task with a will. I did not contradict it, you may be sure, though I cannot conceive he should have beat so far westwards yet. Lord, how we toiled in the broiling sun! Mr. Bowes, the purser, was a great support, are you not amazed? But he is the most seamanlike officer, and he and Bondon, until he boiled himself with tar, supplied the boatswain's place to admiration. William Babington, too, is an excellent young man, though he was harpooned by a lamentable trollopy wench the moment he set foot ashore, and eventually was obliged to be placed under restraint. However, when we really set to, in consequence of a damned odd contretemps I shall tell you about, he behaved nobly. And young Callow, the very hideous boy, is shaping well. It was very good for the midshipmen to see a thorough refit carried through at the double, with some operations that are rarely done when a ship is in commission, and I kept them by me all the time. I hardly went ashore either, apart from duty calls and a dinner with the Admiral. Now here, dearest Sophie, I enter into shoaling water without a chart, and I am afraid I may run myself aground, being, as you know, no great hand with a pen. However, I shall carry on as best I can, trusting in your candour to read me aright. Scarcely an hour before I received your last packet, I was amazed to learn Diana Villiers was in Bombay, and that you knew, and Stephen knew she was there. Two things came into my mind directly. In the first place, I conceived it might cause you uneasiness, was I to go ashore, she being there. In the second, I was much concerned for Stephen. I break no confidence, for he has never spoke to me about such matters, not plain, I mean, when I tell you he has been, and I fear still is, much attached to Diana. He is a deep old file, and I do not pretend to any great penetration, but I love him more than any one but you, and strong affection supplies what intellect don't. He lit up like a boy when we reached soundings. I wondered at it at the time, and he lit up again when I mentioned her name, though he tried to hide it. He had known she was in Bombay from the beginning. When he landed, he found out she was away, up country, but that she should be back on the 17th. He had the strongest intention of seeing her, and there is no shaking him, of course. I turned it over in my mind, and it was certain to me that either she would use him barbarously, or he would fight Canning, or both. He is better than he was, far, far better, but he is in no fit state to fight, or to be treated rough. So I decided to get away to sea by that date, all the more so that it would bring me home earlier. And by going very hard at our refitting, I flattered myself I had brought it off. But I must say I had my doubts. He vanished for days and days, and I was very dissatisfied with him for cutting a muster, and for not being aboard to see to his stores and the sick bay. There was no finding him, no word from him, and when Mr. Stanhope came aboard, he mentioned having been with him and Mrs. Villiers to Elephanta Island. I had made up my mind to put him under arrest if I could lay my hands on him, but I could not. I was angry, as well as being very concerned, and I determined, when he came aboard, to give him an official rebuke, as well as a piece of my private mind, as a friend. We were at single anchor in the channel, Blue Peter at the fore since daybreak, when his boat appeared at last. And what with the heat, the anxiety, the jaded feeling of having been up all night, and some foolish words with the envoy's secretary, who would be making a nuisance of himself, I was ready to give him a trebly shotted broadside. But when I saw him, my heart failed me. You would not credit how unhappy and ill he looked. He is as dark as a native with the sun, but yet he somehow looked pale. Grey is more the mark. I am afraid she must have been most bitterly unkind, for although we have been at sea some days now, and although we are back in our regular course, sailing with a fair wind for escort on a warm sea, which is the best way I know of setting the ugly side of shore life far astern, his spirits don't recover. I could almost wish for some benign plague to break out in the ship to rouse him. But so far only Babington is on the sick list. The rest of the ship's company are amazingly well, apart from Mr. Rattray and a couple of men with a sunstroke. I have never seen him so low, and now I am very glad I did not reprove him. Apart from anything else, it would have been precious awkward, living together, mewed up so close together as we are, block by block, with Mr. Stanhope and his people taking up all the room. However, at least I think we may hope it is all over, and salt water and absence will waste it away. He is sitting over against me now, on the starboard locker, studying in a Malay dictionary, and you would say he was quite old. How I wish we could find one of Monsieur de Linois's frigates and lay her aboard, yardarm to yardarm. We ply our guns pretty brisk now, and I make no doubt we should thump it into her with some effect. There is nothing like it for suddenly raising your spirits. And even a man of war, which don't fetch much in the way of prize money, being in general handled rough before you can get possession of her, would set us up in a neat cottage. I have been thinking so of this neat cottage, Sophie. Pullings understands everything in the earthy line, his people having a farm, and I have been talking to him about gardening, and it is clear to me that with proper attention, two people, not much given to luxury, could feed admirably well off a rood of moderate land. I should never grow tired of fresh green stuff, nor potatoes, for that matter, after so many years of hard tack. In this drawing you will see I have attended to the due rotation of crops. Plot A is root vegetables for the first year. Heaven knows when you will see the plan, but with any luck we may fall in with the company's China fleet, and if we do, I shall send this and the rest of my packet by one of them. Many of the homeward-bound China ships don't touch at Calcutta or Madras, and then you may have it before Christmas. However, the fleet's motions depend on Linois's. If he's anywhere near the Straits, they won't sail, so perhaps I shall be my own postman after all.
He drifted into a reverie, seeing trim rows of cabbages, cauliflowers, leeks, stout and well-grown, untouched by caterpillars, wireworms, leather jackets, or the dread onion fly. A trout stream at the bottom of the garden with good pasture along its banks, and on the good pasture a mild pair of cows, Jersey cows. Following the stream down he saw the channel at no great distance, with ships upon it, and through the temperate haze upon this sea he was conscious of Stephen smiling at him.
"Will you tell me what you were musing upon now?" said Stephen. "It must have been rarely pleasant."
"I was thinking about marriage," said Jack, "and the garden that goes with it."
"Must you have a garden when you are married?" cried Stephen. "I was not aware."
"Certainly," said Jack. "I had provided myself with a prize, and my cabbages were already springing up in rank and file. I don't know how I shall bear to cut the first. Stephen," he cried, suddenly breaking off, "should you like to see a relic of my youth? I had hoped to show it to you when we were alongside the Sheerhulk, but you did not turn up. However, I have preserved it. The sight will raise your heart."
"I should be happy to see a relic of your youth," said Stephen.
And they walked on to the calm deck, calm with the peace of Sunday afternoon, calm and placidly crowded. The awning rigged for church was rigged still, and beneath its shade the gunroom officers, Mr. Stanhope's people, and most of the midshipmen took their ease, or as much of it as they could, for now that church was over, the cabins, the coaches, the gunrooms, and the berths, hen coops, and smaller livestock, including Mr. Stanhope's nanny goat, had reappeared, and since there was little air to temper the fiery sun, the surprise was running before the wind, they were all crowded into the shade. Yet at the same time the officer of the watch took his ritual turns fore and aft, with a telescope under his arm, while the mate and the midshipman of the watch paced all the quarter-deck that was available on the other side. The timonier stood at the wheel, the quartermaster conned the ship, two boys, the duty messengers, stood meek as mice, though often trodden upon, in their due places, and an eager young Bombay mongoose threaded busily among them all, frightening the hens. Jack paused to compliment Mr. White on his sermon, a strongly worded confutation of Arminianism, and to inquire for Mr. Stanhope, who had managed to take a little dry toast and broth, and who hoped to recover his sea legs in a day or two. Followed by Stephen, he moved forward along the gangway, filled with seamen in their Sunday rig, many a splendid Indian handkerchief, some gazing over the hammock cloths at the empty sea, or conversing with their mates in the chains,
some walking up and down, revelling in idleness, and so to the forecastle, which was deeply packed with men. For not only was it too hot to stay below, but a game was in progress, the ancient country game of grinning through a horse collar, with a prize for who should be the most hideous. The collar was the hoop through which hammocks had to be passed, and the probable winner, to judge from the infinite mirth, was the loblolly boy, the surgeon's lay assistant. A weak head for figures had undone him as a butcher in the Bahamas, but he was a firm hand at the operating table and no mean dissector. Ordinarily he remained at a certain distance from the unlearned, but now, with Sunday's grog and the stirring of his youth, he was grinning like a Goth, amaranthine purple with the strain. Grinning, that is to say, until his suffused eyes met Stephen's, when its face resolved itself into a reasonable shape, assumed a sickly look between greeting and confusion, simpered unhappily, but lacked the quickness to remove itself from the hoop. Silently as a ghost and unseeing, Jack climbed slowly up the foremast shrouds, thrust his head through the lubber's hole, heard the click of dice, the deadly, illegal 50 strokes at the gangway dice, and the horrified cry, "It's the skipper!" He looked down to guide Stephen's hands, and when at last he heaved himself into the top, the men were standing in a huddle, mute by the larboard dead-eyes. They were used to an unnaturally active captain, but the foretop, and of a Sunday, and through the lubber's hole, it passed human belief. Faster Dowdle, the only one whose wits could stand the strain, had swept the dice into his mouth. He stood now fixing the horizon with an absent gaze, a strikingly criminal expression on his face. Jack gave them a remote, passing look and a smile, said,
"Carry on, carry on,"
and sat down on a stunsail to haul Stephen through, in spite of his peevish cries of, "Perfectly capable of coming up, of repeatedly mounted by the phallic shroud scores of times. Pray do not encumber me with your needless solicitude." Once up, he too sat upon the stunsail and gasped for a while. He put enormous effort into climbing, and now the sweat was running down his meagre cheeks.
"So this is the foretop," he observed. "I have been into the mizzen-top and the main-top, but never here. It is very like the others, very like indeed. The same ingenious arrangements of caps, double masts, and those round things. Have you noticed, my dear sir, that it is virtually identical with the rest?"
"An odd coincidence, ain't it?" said Jack. "I do not believe I've ever heard it remarked upon before."
"And is your relic here?"
"Why, no, not exactly. It is a little higher up. You do not mind going a little higher up?"
"Not I," said Stephen, glancing aloft to where the topmast soared, up and up, through the brilliant, diffused light, the only straight object in a billowy whiteness criss-crossed with curving ropes. "You mean to the next story? Or stage?"
"Certainly."
"Then in that case I shall take off my coat, breeches, stockings. Lambswool stockings at 3 and 9 the pair are not to be hazarded lightly."
As he sat unfastening his knee buckles, he stared heavily at the men by the rail.
"Faster Dowdle," he said, "has my rhubarb answered? How are your bowels, my good friend? Show me your tongue."
"Oh, not on Sunday, doctor," said Jack.
Faster Dowdle was a valuable upper yard man. He had no wish to see him at the gangway.
"You are forgetting that today is Sunday. Mellish, take great care of the doctor's wig. Put the watch and the money into it, and the handkerchief on top. Come now, clap on to the shrouds, doctor, not the ratlins, and always look up, not down. Take it easy, and I will follow you and place your feet."
Up and up they went, passing the lookout perched on the yardarm, who assumed an attitude of intense vigilance. Still higher, and Jack swarmed round the mast, up into the cross-trees, and heaved Stephen's now submissive body into place, passed a line round it, and called upon him to open his eyes.
"Why, this is superb!" he cried, convulsively hugging the mast.
They were poised high above the surface of the sea, and all that was visible of the distant, narrow deck through the topsails and courses seemed peopled with dolls, foreshortened dolls that moved with disproportionate strides, their feet reaching too far in front and too far behind.
"Superb!" he said again. "How vast the sea has become! How luminous!"
Jack laughed to see his evident pleasure, his bright and attentive wandering eye, and said,
"Look forward!"
The frigate had no headsails set, the wind being aft, and the taut lines of the forestays plunged, slanting down, in a clean, satisfying geometry. Below them the ship's head with its curving rails, and then the long, questing bowsprit,
reaching far out into the infinity of ocean. With a steady, measured, living rhythm, her bows plunged into the dark blue water, splitting it, shouldering it aside in dazzling foam. He sat for a long while, gazing down. With the long, slow pitch, no roll, they were swept 50 feet forward through the air each time the frigate put her head down, then slowly up to the vertical, a pause, and the forward rush again.
"How much area it is at this great height," he observed at last.
"Yes,"
said Jack,
"it is always so. In the light air, for example, your royals will give you as much thrust as the courses, even more."
He looked up at the royal pole, rising bare into the unclouded sky, and he was weighing the dynamic advantages of a fitted mast with one part of his mind when another part told him he was being uncivil, that Stephen had asked him a question and was waiting for an answer. He reconstructed the words as well as he could. Had he ever considered the ship thus seen as a figure of the present, the untouched sea before it as the future, the bow wave as the moment of perception, of immediate existence, and replied,
"I cannot truly say I have, but it is a damn good figure, and all the more to my liking, as the sea is as bright and toward today as ever your heart could wish. I hope it pleases you, old Stephen."
"It does indeed. I have really been more moved, delighted, and I am most sensible of your kindness in carrying me up. I dare say you, for your part, have been here pretty often."
"Lord, when I was amid in this very ship, old Fidge used to masthead me for a nothing. A fine seaman, but testy. Died of the yellowjack in 97. And I spent hours beyond number here. This is where I did nearly all my reading."
"A venerable spot."
"Ah," cried Jack, "if I had a guinea for every hour I have spent up here, I should not be worrying about prizes, nor discounting bills on my next quarter's pay. I should have been married long ago."
"This question of money preoccupies your mind. Mine too, at times. How pleasant it would be to be able to offer one's friend a rope of pearls. And then again, such deeply stupid men are able to come by wealth, often by no exertion, by no handling or even possession of merchandise, but merely by writing figures in a book. My Parsee, for example, assured me that if only he had the hard word about Linoise's whereabouts, he and his associates would make lakh upon lakh of rupees."
"How would he do that?"
"By a variety of speculations, particularly upon rice. Bombay cannot feed itself, and with Linois off Mahé, for instance, no rice ships would sail. Clearly the price would rise enormously, and the thousands of tons in the Parsee's nominal possession would sell for a very much greater sum. Then there are the funds, or their Indian equivalent, which lie far beyond my understanding. Even an untrue word intelligently spread and based upon the statement of an honest man would answer, I collect. It is called rigging the market."
"Aye? Well, damn them for a pack of greasy hounds. Let me show you my relic. I preserved it, south of Madagascar, and I preserved it in Bombay. You will have to stand up. Steady now. Clap on to the cheek-bolt. There."
He pointed to the cap, a dark, worn, rope-scored, massive block of wood that embraced the two masts.
"We cut it out of Greenheart in a creek on the Spanish Main. It is good for another 20 years. And here, do you see, is my relic."
On the broad rim of the square hole that sat on the topmast head, there were the initials J.A., cut deep and clear, supported on either side by blousy forms that might have been manatees, though mermaids were more likely, beer-drinking mermaids.
"Does not that raise your heart?"
he asked.
"Why," said Stephen, "I am obliged to you for the sight of it, sure."
"But it does raise your heart, you know, whatever you may say,"
said Jack.
"It raises it 100 feet above the deck. Ha, ha! I can get out a good thing now and then, given time. Ha, ha, ha! You never smoked it. You was not aware of my motions."
When Jack was as amused as this, so intensely amused throughout his whole massive being, belly and all, with his scarlet face glorious and shining, and his blue eyes darting mirth from their narrowed slits, it was impossible to resist. Stephen felt his mouth widen involuntarily, his diaphragm contract, and his breath beginning to come in short, thick pants.
"But I am truly grateful to you, my dear," he said, "for having brought me to this proud, perilous eminency, this quasi-apex, this apogee. You have indeed lifted my heart, in the spirit and in the flesh,
and I am now resolved to mount up daily. I now despise the mizzen-top, once my Ultima Thule, and I even aspire to that knob up there," nodding to the truck of the Royal. "What an ape, or even I may say an obese post-captain, can accomplish, that also I can do."
These words, and the conviction with which they were uttered, wiped the laugh off Jack's face.
"Each man to his own trade," he began earnestly. "Apes and I are born—"
The lookouts hail.
"On deck there!"
directed nevertheless straight up at the captain.
"Sail ho!"
cut him short.
"Where away?"
he cried.
2 points on the larboard bow, sir."
"Mr. Pullings! Mr. Pullings there! Be so good as to send my glass into the four-cross trees."
A moment later Mr. Callow appeared, having run from the cabin to the cross-trees without a pause, and the white fleck in the southeast leapt nearer. A ship, close-hauled on the starboard tack, topsails and courses, taking it easy. Already there was a hint of her dark hull on the rise. She would be about 4 leagues away. At the moment the Surprise was running 7 or 8 knots with no great spread of canvas, and she had the weather gauge. There was plenty of time. "Lose not a minute" was engraved on his heart, however, and saying,
"Shin up to the jacks, Mr. Callow, do not watch the chase but the sea beyond her. Doctor, pray do not stir for the moment."
He hailed the deck for his coxswain and swung himself into the shrouds with a speed just short of hurry. He met the ascending Bond and said,
"Bring the doctor down handsomely, Bonden. He is to be dressed, full rig in the top,"
and so reached the quarter-deck.
"What have they seen, Captain?" cried Atkins, running towards him. "Is it the enemy? Is it Lenoir?"
"Mr. Pullings, all hands to make sail. Maintogallantsail, stunsails, and royal, and scandalise the foretopsail yard."
"Maintogallantsail, stunsails, and royal, and scandalise for topsail yard it is, sir."
The boatswain's call piped with a fine urgency. The ship was filled with the unaccustomed click of Sunday shoes, and Jack heard Atkins's shrill voice cut off suddenly as the afterguard bowled him over. In a few moments the wild melee had resolved itself into ordered groups of men aloft and alow, each at his appointed rope. The orders came in the dead silence. In quick succession the sails were sheeted home, and as each filled on the steady breeze, so a stronger impulse sent the ship faster through the water. Her whole voice changed, and the rhythm of her pitch, all far more living, brilliantly awake. At the last cry of
"Belay!"
Jack looked at his watch. It was pretty well. They were not livelies yet, not by 1:40, but it was pretty well. He caught a look of whistling astonishment on his new first lieutenant's face, and he smiled privately.
"South-southwest to half-south," he said to the helmsman. "Mr. Pullings, I believe you may dismiss the watch below."
The watch below did in fact vanish into the berth deck, but only to take off its best shirts, embroidered at the seams with ribbons, its spotless white trousers, and little low-cut shoes with bows. It reappeared a few minutes later in working clothes and gathered on the forecastle, in the head and the foretop, staring fixedly at the sail on the horizon. By this time Jack had begun his ritual pace from the break of the quarter-deck to the taffrail. At each turn he glanced up at the rigging and across the sea to the distant chase, for chase she had become in the frigate's predatory eyes, although in fact she was not in flight. Far from it. Her course lay rather towards the Surprise than from her. At this moment she was a whiteness just clear of the larboard lower stunsail, and if she held her luff she would soon disappear behind it. Now that the whole of the fresh impulse had been transmitted to the frigate's hull, now that her upper masts had ceased their momentary complaint, and that the backstays were less iron-taut, she was racing through the water. She had nothing on her mizzen-mast. On her main topsail t'gallant, with stunsails on either side, and royal, her mainsail being hauled up to let the wind into her foresail. And on her foremast, the course, with both lower stunsails spread like wings, no topsail, the main topsail would have becalmed it, but the topsail yard on the masthead and its stunsails set. She was running very smoothly, rippling over the swell with an eager forward thrust, not a hint of steering wild. Their courses should converge in about 1 hour at this rate. Rather less. He might have to reduce sail. And if the chase wore and flared, he still had his spritsail and the kites in hand, as well as an advantage of some 2 or 3 knots in all likelihood. The civilians had been reduced to silence, or shepherded below. Mr. Starton was hurrying quietly about, making ready for the possible order to clear for action, and in the silence of voices, but almost silence, of the following wind, all that was to be heard was the steady run of water along her side, an urgent bubbling rush that mingled with a higher excited tumult of her wake. Six bells. Braithwaite, the mate of the watch, came to the rail with the log.
"Is the glass clear?" he cried.
"All clear, sir," said the quartermaster.
Braithwaite heaved the log. It shot astern.
"Turn,"
he said, as the mark tore through his fingers, the reel screeching aloud.
"Stop!"
shouted the quartermaster, 28 seconds later.
11 knots and 6 fathoms, sir, if you please,"
reported Braithwaite to Pullings, official gravity fighting a losing battle with delight. All hands were listening nakedly. A murmur of intense satisfaction ran through the ship.
"Give it her,"
said Pullings, and stepped closer to Jack's path.
"How do we come along, Mr. Pullings?"
said he.
11 knots and 6 fathoms, sir, if you please," said Pullings with a grin.
"Hey, hey!" cried Jack. "I scarcely believed it could be so much."
He looked lovingly along her deck and up to where her pendant flew out in a curving flame 50 foot long, almost straight ahead. She was indeed a noble ship. She always had been, but she had never run 11 knots 6 fathoms off the reel when he was a boy. By now the chase had vanished from his view, and if she held her course he would not see her again until she was within gunshot, unless he went forward. Stephen was sitting on the capstan, eating a mangosteen, and staring at the mongoose as it played with his handkerchief, tossing it up, catching it, worrying it to death.
"We are running 11 knots 6, said Jack.
"Oh," said Stephen, "I am sorry to hear it. Most concerned. Is there no remedy?"
"I fear not,"
said Jack, shaking his head.
"Do you choose to walk forward?"
From the forecastle she was even nearer than he had expected. Hull up, same sails, same course.
"I speak under correction, and with great diffidence," said Stephen, as Jack fixed her in his glass. "But I should have supposed our progress satisfactory, seeing that the vessel is notoriously weak and old, even decrepit. See how she dashes the foam aside. See how the water is as it was excavated in a deep trough on either bow. I can see a yard of her copper at least. I never remember to have seen so deeply down her side. From the flying spray alone, and my good coat is soaked, I should have judged our pace adequate, unless indeed we are to indulge in this modern frenzy for speed."
"It is not our speed that is unsatisfactory," said Jack.
He lowered the telescope, wiped the object glass, and peered again.
"It is that ugly Dutch-built interloping tub."
And to be sure, the tension on the forecastle had been slackening fast, as the probable nature of the chase became more and more apparent. In all likelihood, she was one of the company's country ships bound for Bombay. What else would have held an untroubled course, with a man of war bearing down on her under press of sail? Her checkered sides, her 10 gun ports, her martial air might deceive foreigners, but the Navy had smoked her at once for a vile merchantman, no enemy nor no prize.
"Well, I'm glad we did not clear away even the bow chasers,"
said Jack, walking aft.
"Proper flats we should have looked if we had run alongside, stripped and bristling with guns. Mr. Pullings, you may take in the Royal and the T'gallant stunsails."
Half an hour later, the two ships lay hove to, with backed topsails, wallowing in the swell, and the master of the Seringapatam came across, navy fashion, in an elegant barge with a uniformed crew. He came grunting up the side, followed by a lascar with a parcel, saluted the quarterdeck, and limped towards Jack with a smile on his face, and his hand held out.
"You do not recognise me, sir,"
he said.
"Theobald, of the Orion."
"Theobald, God love you,"
cried Jack, all his reserve vanishing at once.
"How happy I am to see you. Killick, Killick! Where is that mumping villain?"
"What now?" said Killick angrily, 2 feet behind him. "Sir."
"Iced punch in the coach, and bear a hand."
"How do you do, Killick?"
said Theobald.
"Tolerable, sir, I thank you. Up to my duty, sir, though hardious. We was wholly grieved to hear of your mishap, sir."
"Thank'ee, Killick. Yet it is a saving in neat's leather, you know. We made out the surprise the moment you was topsails up,"
he said to Jack.
"I never thought to see that taut old mainmast again." "You had no notion of our being Lenoir?"
"God bless you, no. He will be in the Isle of France by now, if not at the Cape. Quite out of these waters."
They walked into the fore cabin, and when at last they walked out again, Theobald was a fine, deep crimson, and Jack not much lighter, and their strong nautical voices could be heard from one end of the ship to the other. Theobald gripped the side ropes, and by the strength of his arms alone he let himself down, his face disappearing like a setting sun. When he had seen his friend bob over the water and swarm aboard the Seringapatam,
and when the ships had parted with the usual civilities, Jack turned to Stephen and said,
"Well, that was a sad disappointment for you, I'm afraid. Not so much as a gun. Come and help me finish the punch. It is the last of the snow, and God knows when you will have a cool drink again this side of Java."
In the cabin, he said,
"I must beg your pardon for not naming Theobald to you, but there is nothing so tedious as sitting by when two old shipmates are calling out, 'Do you remember the 3 days' blow in the Mona Passage? Do you remember Wilkins and his Temenagai? What has happened to old Blodge? He is a fine fellow, however, capital seaman, but having no interest, he could not get a command. 18 years a lieutenant. Indeed, having contrived to blow off his leg, he could not get a ship either. So he turned to the company, and here he is commanding a tea wagon. Poor chap. How lucky I am, in comparison of him."
"Certainly. I feel much for the gentleman. But he seems to be of a sanguine humour, and Pullings tells me the captains of Indiamen become exceedingly rich. They shake the pagoda tree like true British tars."
"Rich? Oh, yes, they wallow in gold. But he will never hoist his flag. No, no, poor fellow, he will never hoist his flag. However, old shipmate or not, he had wretched news for us. First that Lenoir had taken his squadron off to the Isle of France to refit. They must be infernally short of stores, with no port this side of the ocean, so they cannot be back in these waters this monsoon, if at all, not within 3,000 miles of us. And second, that the company's China fleet has sailed. He had had news of them in the Sunda Strait, so we shall not meet 'em."
"What of it?"
"I had so looked forward to getting my packet off to England, and I am sure you would have liked to do the same. However, salt water washes away disappointment, as well as other things. I have often been amazed at how you forget after a few days at sea. You might be sailing in Lethe once you have sunk the land. I said you might be sailing in Lethe once you have sunk the land."
"Yes, I heard you. I do not agree. What is the object behind you, on the locker?"
"It is a case of pistols."
"No, no. The ill-wrapped parcel from which feathers protrude."
"Oh, that. I had meant to show it you earlier. Theobald brought it me. It is for Sophie, a paradise bird. Was it not handsome in him? But he was always as open-handed as the day. He picked it up some time ago in the Spice Islands, and he very candidly told me he had meant it for his sweetheart to put in her hat. But it seems she turned sour and threw him over for a cove in the law line, I believe, the secondary of the Poultry Compter. He did not mind it much, he said. What could a fellow with a wooden leg expect? And he wished them happiness in this very mole. But he hoped it would bring me better luck. Do you feel it might be a trifle ostentatious in a hat? Perhaps more suitable for a chimney-piece, or a fire-screen?"
"What emerald splendour! What a demi-ruff! I hardly know what to call it. What a tail! Never have I beheld such extreme, delicate magnificence. A cockbird, of course." He sat, handling the brilliant feathers, the improbable streaming tail, and Jack pondered mildly over a joke, or pun, connecting this fowl with the Poultry Compter, but abandoned it as heartless to Theobald. Stephen said, "Have you ever contemplated upon sex, my dear?"
"Never,"
said Jack.
"Sex has never entered my mind at any time."
"The burden of sex, I mean. This bird, for example, is very heavily burdened, almost weighed down. He can scarcely fly or pursue his common daily round with any pleasure to himself, encumbered by a yard of tail and all this top hamper. All these extravagant plumes have but one function, to induce the hen to yield to his importunities. How the poor cock must glow and burn if these are, as they must be, an index of his ardour."
"That is a solemn thought."
"Were he a capon now, his life would be easier by far. These spurs, these fighting spurs, would vanish. His conduct would become peaceable, social, complacent, and mild. Indeed, were I to castrate all the surprises, Jack, they would grow fat, placid, and unaggressive. This ship would no longer be a man of war, darting angrily, hastily, from place to place, and we should circumnavigate the terraqueous globe with never a harsh word. There would be none of this disappointment in missing Lenoir."
"Never mind the disappointment. Salt water will wash it away. You will be amazed how unimportant it will seem in a week's time, how everything will fall into place."
It was the true word. Once the surprise had turned south about Ceylon to head for the Java Sea, the daily order seized upon them all. The grind of holy stones, the sound of swabs and water on the decks at first light, hammocks piped up, breakfast and its pleasant smells, the unvarying succession of the watches, noon and the altitude of the sun, dinner, grog. Roast beef of Old England on the drum for the officers. Moderate feast. Quarters. The beating of the retreat. The evening roar of guns. Topsails reefed. The setting of the watch. And then the long, warm starlight. Moonlit evenings, often spent on the quarterdeck, with Jack leading his two bright midshipmen through the intricate delights of astral navigation. This life, with its rigid pattern punctuated by the sharp, imperative sound of bells, seemed to take on something of the nature of eternity as they slanted down towards the line, crossing it in 91 degrees of latitude east of Greenwich. The higher ceremonies of divisions, of mustering by the open list, church, the articles of war, marked the due order of time, rather than its passage, and before they had been repeated twice, most of the frigate's people felt both past and future blur, dwindling almost into insignificance. An impression all the stronger, since the surprise was once more in a lonely sea, 2,000 miles of dark blue water, with never an island to break its perfect round, not the faintest smell of land, even on the strongest breeze. The ship was a world self-contained, swimming between two perpetually renewed horizons. Stronger still, because in these waters there was no eager impatience to see over the eastward rim. They sailed with no relation to an enemy, nor to any potential prize. The Dutch were bottled up. The French had disappeared. The Portuguese were friends. They were not idle. Mr. Starton had a high notion of a first lieutenant's duties, a religious horror of anything approaching dirt or shakings. His speaking trumpet was rarely out of his hand, and the cry of "Sweepers! Sweepers!" resounded through the ship as often as the voice of the cuckoo in May, and with something of the same intonation. He had at once fallen in with his captain's views on discipline, and with great relief. But the force of habit was strong, and the surprise might have been inspected by an admiral any day without having to blush for it. Starton was much more efficient than Hervey. It was clear that he could see to the daily running of the ship. In a thoroughly worked-up frigate, with a captain who knew what he was about, any fairly competent officer could have done so, but Starton did it excellently. It is true that the midshipman's berth often wished him in hell in the early morning, but his natural cheerfulness was a real addition to the domestic comfort of the gunroom. The frigate's sailing qualities were Jack's concern, however. His master, Harrowby, was no phoenix either in navigation or seamanship. In the hurry of their departure, Harrowby had allowed an imperfect stowing of the hold, and the ship, as soft-mouthed as a filly with her fine narrow entry, would neither lie as close to the wind as Jack could have wished, nor stay with the smooth and certain rapidity that was in her power. She was splendid, sailing large, had never been better. But by the wind she left much to be desired. There was a slowness, a tendency to gripe, and want of ease that no fresh combination of sails would overcome. And it was not until they reached the line that pumping their water from one tier to another and shifting several thousand shot brought her by the stern enough to give him some ease of mind. It was only a half measure, to be sure, and the true solution must wait until they could land a mass of stores, come at the ballast and the ground tier, and restow the hold. But even this alteration in her trim made her a pleasure to steer. He had a great deal to do. So had the frigate's people. But there were many evenings when the hands danced and sang on the forecastle, and when Jack and Stephen played, sometimes in their narrow coach, sometimes on the quarterdeck, and sometimes in the great cabin. Trios with Mr. Stanhope, who blew a tremulous, small-voiced flute, and who had a great deal of sheet music by him. The envoy's delicate health had taken great benefit from Bombay, and after his week of seasickness, his strength and spirits recovered remarkably. He and Stephen often sat together, hearing one another their Malay verbs or rehearsing his address to the Sultan of Kampong. It was to be delivered in French, a language that Mr. Stanhope did not possess in great perfection. Nor, was it to be presumed, did the Sultan. But there was a French resident at Kampong, and Mr. Stanhope felt that for his master's credit he must be word perfect, and they went through it again and again, breaking down every time at
Roy des 36 parapluies, et très illustre seigneur de 1000 éléphants.
Mr. Stanhope transposing the seigneur and the elephants out of mere nervousness. The address was to be translated phrase by phrase into Malay by his new Oriental secretary, a gentleman of mixed parentage from Ben Coolan, found for the envoy by the governor of Bombay. Mr. Atkins looked upon the new arrival with hatred and suspicion. He tried to make Mr. Ahmed Smythe's life miserable, but outwardly at least he was unsuccessful, for in the Oriental Secretary the Malay predominated, and his large, black, somewhat oblique eyes shone with merriment. Mr. Stanhope tried to keep the peace between them, but often and often Atkins's harsh nasal voice would be heard issuing from the cabin, little or no privacy in a vessel 30 yards long with 200 men crammed into it, complaining of some infringement of his prerogatives, some slight, and then the envoy's gentle conciliating murmur, assuring him Smythe was a very good, well-behaved, civil, attentive fellow, that he meant no harm, had no idea of encroaching. Ahmed Smythe was popular in the ship, although, being a Mohammedan and suffering from his liver, he drank no wine. And when the rearrangement of the frigate's bowels set free a space long enough to swing a hammock in, Mr. Starton had it screened off as a cabin for the foreign gentleman. This so vexed Atkins, who was obliged to share with poor Mr. Barclay, with whom he was no longer on speaking terms, that he came to Stephen and begged him to use his influence with the captain, to put an end to a gross injustice, a monstrous abuse of authority. "I cannot interfere with the running of the ship," said Stephen.
"Then H.E. will have a word with Aubrey himself," said Atkins. "It is intolerable. Every day this nigger finds some new way of provoking me. If he don't take care, I shall provoke him, I can tell you."
"Do you mean you will fight him?" asked Stephen.
"That is a course no one with your welfare at heart could advise." "Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Maturin,"
cried Atkins, grasping his hand. He was extremely sensitive to even the most fallacious appearance of affection, poor man.
"But that is not what I meant. Oh, no! A man of my family does not fight with a half-caste nigger clerk, not even a Christian. After all, un gentilhomme est toujours gentilhomme."
"Compose yourself, Mr. Atkins," said Stephen, for the enthusiasm with which Atkins spoke these last words brought the blood to his nose and ears.
"In these latitudes indulgence in passion may bring on a calenture. I do not like your mottled face. You eat too much, drink too much, and are a likely victim."
Yet it was Mr. Stanhope that suffered from the calenture. One afternoon, when Ahmed Smythe dined with the gunroom, Atkins could be heard ranting away in the cabin. Some feet above the open skylight, the carpenter rested his mallet and said privately to his mate,
"If I was His Excellency, I should put that bugger into the jolly boat with a pound of cheese and bid him look out for another place."
"How he does badger and worry the poor old gent, to be sure. You would think they was married. I feel for him, poor old gent. Always a civil word."
A little later Mr. Stanhope's valet brought his master's compliments. He begged to be excused from their party at whist, and would be most grateful for a word with Dr. Maturin at his leisure. Stephen found him looking tired and old and discouraged. It was this wretched bile again, he thought, and should be infinitely obliged for half of a blue pill, or whatever Dr. Maturin judged proper. A thready, uneven pulse, a high temperature, dry skin, an anxious face, a brilliant eye. Stephen prescribed bark, his favourite slime draught, and a blue-coloured placebo. They had some effect, and Mr. Stanhope was more comfortable in the morning. Yet his strength did not return, nor his appetite. Stephen was not pleased with his patient, whose temperature rose and fell, with an alternation of febrile excitement and languor that he had never seen before. Mr. Stanhope found the heat very hard to bear, yet every day they drew nearer to the equator, and every day the wind died to the smallest breeze between 10 and 2. They set up a wind sail for him to direct the air into the cabin, where he lay, dry, thin, yellow, suffering from continual nausea, but always polite, always grateful for any attention, apologetic. Stephen and Mallister had a fair library of books on tropical medicine. They read them through and through, and admitted to one another, but in Latin, that they were at sea.
"There is at least one thing we can do," observed Stephen. "We can get rid of one external source of irritation."
Mr. Atkins was forbidden the cabin on doctor's orders, and Stephen spent most of his nights there, generally accompanied by the valet, or Mr. White. He was fond of the envoy. He wished him very well. But above all, he was professionally committed. This was a case in which close Hippocratic attention must take the place of drugs. The patient was too weak, the disease too little understood for any radical measures, and he sat by Mr. Stanhope's bedside, watch after watch, while the ship moved quietly through the phosphorescent sea. This, he reflected, was his true occupation. This, not the self-destructive pursuit of a woman far beyond his reach. Medicine, as he saw it, was largely impersonal, and although its effect might be humane, Atkins would have received much the same care. What were his motives, beyond a desire for knowledge, an itch for cataloguing, measuring, naming, recording? His mind wandered away, losing itself in intricate paths, and when he found that his half-waking consciousness was suffused with a rosy pleasure, and that there was a smile upon his face, he brought up his vague ideas with a jerk to find that, in fact, between two bells and the three that had just struck, he had been musing upon Diana Villiers, or rather upon her laughter, particularly bubbling and gay, unaffectedly musical, and the way the hair curled at the nape of her neck.
"Did you do the Otan Timoromenos at school?" whispered Mr. Stanhope.
"I did, too," said Stephen.
"But at sea it is different. I was dreaming of Dr. Bulkley at school and his terrible black face. I really thought I saw him there in the cabin. How he frightened me when I was a little chap. But, however, we are at sea. It is different. Tell me, is it nearly daylight yet? I thought I heard three bells.
Very soon now. Just raise your head, will you now, till I turn your pillow?"
Fresh sheets, sponging, a spoonful of animal soup, sods removed from his cracked lips, black in the candlelight. At four bells Mr. Stanhope fell into a rambling account of the etiquette at the Sultan's court. Mr. Smythe told him the Malay rulers were very particular about precedence. His Majesty's representative must not give way to any improper claim. He hoped he should do right. Sponging, a change of position, the small personal ignominies. Mr. Stanhope was as shamefaced as a girl. Day after day Stephen felt the balance shift and vary, but after a fortnight of unremitting care he walked into the sickbay, his eyes sunk and dark-rimmed with fatigue, and said,
"Mr. Mallister, a good morning to you. I believe we may cry Io triumph, at least as far as the anorexia is concerned. We had a pretty crisis at four, with a laudable exudation, and a little after six the patient took 11 ounces of animal soup. It is the animal soup that bears the bell away. The animal soup for ever! The vicious anomaly of the pulse remains, and the palpable liver, but I think we may look forward to a gain in weight and strength."
By day they slung his cot on the weather side of the quarter-deck, and the surprises were happy to see him again. He and his people and his baggage, presents and livestock, had been a great nuisance to them these 15,000 miles now. But as they said, the Excellency was a civil gentleman, always had a civil word, not like some touch-me-not sodomites, and they were used to him. They liked what they were used to, and they rejoiced to see him getting better as the frigate slipped away south and eastwards through stronger, cooler winds. Much fresher winds and more uncertain. Sometimes they would fairly box the compass, and now it was no unusual thing for the Surprise to strike her t'gallant masts down on deck, hand her courses, and proceed under close-reefed topsails alone. It was on such a day as this, a Sunday, with Jack dining in the gunroom, where the conversation was running on the wild beasts to be met with in Java, whose western tip, the opening of the Sunda Strait they hoped to raise on Monday, that Mr. Stanhope's valet rushed in, his face horrified, staring, and distraught. Stephen left his plate. A few minutes later he sent for Mr. Mallister. Already rumours were flying round the ship. The envoy had been struck down by the strong fives, or apoplexy. He had choked over his wine, and blood, thick blood, was gushing black from his mouth. He was to be opened by the surgeon within the hour, and the instruments were sharpening this minute. He was dead. When he came back to the damped, silent, apprehensive feast, Stephen sat to his meal. And eating it up with no apparent emotion, he said to Jack,
"We have taken the first measures, and he is relatively comfortable, but his state is very grave, and it is essential that he should be set down on land, the nearest firm land, and until we can reach it, the motion of the ship should be reduced as far as possible. Another 24 hours of this bucketing must have a fatal issue. May I trouble you for the wine?"
"Mr. Harrowby, Mr. Pullings, pray come with me," said Jack, throwing down his napkin. "Mr. Starton, you will excuse us."
In a few moments all the sea officers had gone, leaving only Etheridge and the purser. They pushed the cheese towards Stephen, the pudding and the wine, watching silently and uneasily as he made his hearty meal. Jack stood at the charts, with Pullings and the master beside him. The ship's course had been altered to bring the wind on her quarter, and she was lasking along with an easy motion and a little more than her foretopsail. The latest logboard readings had been fetched, and her position was clearly and certainly set down. 5 degrees 13 minutes south, 103 degrees 37 minutes east, Java Head beating west-southwest 70 leagues.
"We could fetch Ben Coolan on this tack," he said, "but not in 4 and 20 hours. Or bear up for Telenjang? No, not with this cross sea. Does he need a civilized town, a hospital, or will any land answer? That is the point."
"I will find out, sir," said Pullings, and coming back, he said, "Any land at all, he says."
"Thank you, Pullings. You know these waters. You must have run through the straits 12 times. Have you anything to suggest?"
"Pull up a tack, sir," said Pullings at once, touching the coast of Sumatra with the dividers. "Inside pull up a tack. We watered there twice in the Lord Clive, both coming and going. It is a right bold shore, 40 fathom water, not a cable's length from the land, and a clean bottom. At the head of the bay there is a stream comes out of the rock. Sweet water you can fill directly into the boats. It ain't civilized, nothing but some little naked black men that beats drums in the woods, but it's purely calm, and the island shelters it from anything but a nor'wester."
"Very well,"
said Jack, hanging over the chart.
"Very well. Mr. Harrowby, lay off the course for Pulo Batak, if you please."
He went on deck to see what sail she could bear and still remain on a fairly even keel. At midnight he was still there, and at dawn. And as the wind failed, so the Surprise silently blossomed, sail by sail, into a pyramid of whiteness. They needed every ounce of thrust to reach Pulo Batak in 24 hours. Their noon altitude showed a fair day's run, and a little after dinner time, no pipes, no drum, they made their landfall. Pullings at the Four Royal Jacks was certain of it, a rounded head with 2 peaks bearing northeast. The ship ghosted along on the unruffled sea, her lofty skysails giving her 4 knots. There was also the strange attraction of the land heaving her in, and presently the whole of the eastern sky was barred with dark mountains, growing greener as she stood on and on. The island guarding the little bay was clear from the deck, with a hint of gentle surf on its westward face, and it looked very much as though the Surprise would drop her anchor within the time laid down. There was still an hour to go. The best bower was already at the Cathead, and all was cleared away when the land breeze set untimely in, coming off strong and gusty, and bringing with it the strong scent of rotting vegetation. The sails slackened, flapped, and her way began to fall off. Jack sent for the deep sea line. It splashed into the sea far forward, and running aft down the side came the familiar cry, strangely muted,
"Watch, watch! Bear away! Veer away!"
And at last the answer he had expected.
"No ground, sir. No ground with 200 fathom.
"All boats away, Mr. Starton," he said. "We must tow her in. Let us hope we reach soundings before the tide sets too strong against us. Mr. Rattray, bend another shot of cable to the small bower, if you please, and rouse out the new 8-inch hawser.
Pullings took her in, conning the ship from the foreyard arm, and when the ebb began to run so hard against them that the boats could no longer give her any headway at all, they dropped the small bower in a prodigious depth, something over 90 fathoms, to hold their ground. This was deeper water than Jack had ever anchored in, and in his anxiety he twice asked Thomas Pullings if he knew what he was at.
"Mr. Pullings, are you happy about our berth?"
They were standing immediately above the hawse hole, with a group of extremely grave forecastlemen, old experienced seamen, behind them.
"Yes, sir," said Pullings. "We rowed here 3 days in the Clive. I'm sure of the bearings, and the bottom is as clean as Gurnard Point. If we veer out to the bitter end, I will answer for it."
"Below there,"
cried Jack down the hatch.
"Double the stoppers. Clap on 2 dogs and veer out to the bitter end."
The Surprise was going fast astern. The cable straightened, rising in a drooping curve and dragging the anchor over the seabed far below. A fluke dug into the bottom, dragged a little further, and held firm. The cable rose again, much higher, much straighter, and as it took the full strain it stretched taut, squirting water, and then brought her up, riding steady. Throughout the tide, Pullings stood there, the responsibility heavy on him, watching the cable and the shore, keeping 3 tall trees in a line to make sure she did not move, drift helplessly out to sea, out to the strong current that set northwest up the coast, so that they might have to beat up for days before they reached the bay again. The ebb ran faster, even faster, gurgling round her stem.
"I've never heard of an anchor holding well nigh a peak, not in 100 fathom water," observed an elderly hand.
It stands to reason, on account of the compression of volume.
You pipe down, Wilkes, cried Pullings, turning sharp upon him. You and your goddamn volumes.
Which I only passed the remark, said Wilkes, but very quietly.
How cruel fast it ebbed. But it was slackening. Surely it was slackening. Babington joined him on the forecastle.
What's o'clock? Asked Pullings.
It wants 5 minutes of half-tide, said Babington. Together they stared at the cable. But it is slackening faster already, he said, and Pullings felt his heart warm to him. After a moment, Babington went on,
We are to buoy the cable and slip as soon as we can tow again. They are making a kind of litter to pass him over the side in.
The ebb ran its course at last. The barge pulled out with the tow-line, buoying the cable in its way, and Pullings went aft, feeling young once more.
Are you ready there below, Mr. Starton?
Called Jack.
All ready, sir,
came the muffled reply.
Then slip the cable. Mr. Pullings, take the jolly boat and lead in. Boats away and stretch out there, do you hear me?
They stretched out. They pulled with a will, and the frigate towed sweetly. But even so it was late evening before she glided past the island, down the sheltered inlet with its tall, jungle-covered sides, green cliffs or bare rock rising sheer from the water down to the far end, where there was a little white crescent of beach and an astonishing waterfall plunging down the black rocks to one side of it, almost the only sound in that strangely oppressive air. The land, which had seemed so green and welcoming from a distance, took on altogether another appearance as they drew in, and 200 yards from the shore a swarm of black flies settled heavily on the ships and the boats, crawling about the rigging, the sails, the deck, and the people. 30 hours, not 24, had gone by before they lifted Mr. Stanhope's litter out of the barge and set it gently down on the sand. The little beach seemed even smaller to Jack as he walked about it. The jungle pressed in on all sides. Huge, improbable fronds overhung the sea-wrack, and the still air, no land breeze here in this lost inlet, was filled with the smell of decay and the hum of mosquitoes. He had heard the sound of a drum in the forest as they came in, and now that his ears were accustomed to the roar of the waterfall, he heard it again, some way inland and to the north, but there was no telling how far off. A troop of fruit bats, each 5 feet across, flew low over the open space and into a vast creeper-covered tree. Following their sinister flight, he thought he saw a dark, man-sized form moving through the mass of green below, and he stepped eagerly towards it. But the jungle wall was impenetrable, the only paths being tunnels 2 or 3 feet high. He turned and looked out over the strand and to sea. They had rigged 2 tents, and a fire was burning bright already in the twilight. A top lantern had been set up, and Etheridge was posting his marines. Beyond the tents lay the ship, no more than a cable's length away, but still in 20 fathom water. She was moored fore and aft to trees on the outward curving shores, and they had laid out the best bower to seaward. She looked huge and tall in this confined space, and lights were moving about on the main deck, behind her open ports. Beyond her rose the island, blocking out the sea. She would lie safe there, even if it came on to blow, and her guns commanded every approach. But he had an uneasy feeling of being watched, and presently he moved down towards the tents.
"Mr. Smythe,"
he said, meeting the Oriental secretary,
"have you been here before?"
"No, sir," said Smythe. "This is not a part of the country the Malays frequent. Oh, no. It belongs to the Orang Bakut, a little black naked people. There. You can hear their drums. They communicate with drums."
"Aye, I dare say. Is the doctor with his patient?"
"No, sir. He is in the other tent, preparing his instruments."
"Stephen, may I come in?"
he said, ducking under the doorway.
"What is your news?"
Stephen tested the edge of his catlin, shaving the hair from his forearm, and said,
"We shall operate as soon as there is light enough, if his strength recovers a little in the night. I have represented to him the alternatives, the delicacy of such an intervention in a body worn by disease, the inevitably fatal outcome of delay. He has made his mind up to the operation as a matter of duty. Mr. White is with him now. I wish his resolution may not falter. I shall require 2 more chests and some leather-bound rope."
It was not Mr. Stanhope's resolution that faltered, but his vital spirit. All night the noises of the jungle kept him from sleep. The drums on either side of the bay disturbed his mind. The motionless heat was more than he could bear. And towards 3 in the morning he died, talking quietly about the ceremonies at the Sultan's court,
and the importance of yielding to no improper claim. The drums and his official reception having, as it were, run into one another. He had little real notion of dying. Through the remaining hours of darkness, Stephen and the chaplain sat with him, listening to the noises outside the tent, the croaking and chuckling of innumerable reptiles, unidentified and countless shrieks, hoots, grunts against a deep background of steady sound, the roar of a tiger, frequently repeated from different places, the continually shifting drums, now close, now far. They buried him in the morning, at the head of the bay, with the marines firing volleys over his grave and the ship thundering out an envoy's salute, raising clouds of birds and flying foxes all round the reverberating cove. All the officers attended in full dress, their swords reversed, and most of the ship's company. Jack took advantage of their sheltered anchorage to correct the frigate's trim, and while this was going forward, the carpenter made a wooden cross. They painted it white, and before the paint was dry, the Surprise stood out to sea, her cables recovered and stowed in the tier, smelling of the mephitic ooze. Jack looked out of the stern window at the distant, receding land, dull purple now, with a rainstorm beating down on it. He said,
"We came on a fool's errand."
Stephen said, as though in reply, All of a piece throughout. Thy chase had a beast in view. Thy wars brought nothing about. Thy lovers were all untrue."
"But still," said Jack after a long pause, "but still we are homeward bound. Homeward bound at last. I am afraid I am required to touch at Calcutta, but it will be touch and go. Calcutta, fare thee well, and home as fast as she will fly. Indeed," he added, having reflected for a while, for a whistling pause, "if we start to fly this very moment, we may yet overhaul the China fleet and send our packets off. They are slow, close-reef topsails every night, old tubs, for all their man-of-war airs and graces. You should not have said that about lovers, Stephen."